are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 16th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Megan Winter, journalist, author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Also on the program today, the Judiciary Committee releases its impeachment report, alleges multiple federal crimes in addition to the high crimes and misdemeanors included in the articles of impeachment. We will see a vote in the House on those impeachment articles on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer wants Mick Mulvaney and John Bolton to testify in the Senate. And freshman Dems want Justin Amash as one of the impeachment managers there. Meanwhile, show you the actual cost of Democrats had they not pursued impeachment. New Jersey Democrat Jeff Von Drew, abandoned by his base for not supporting impeachment, will have to jump to the Republican Party. New poll has Biden and Bernie basically tied nationally. Mike Bloomberg, meanwhile, buying mayoral endorsements as he preps for a potential third-party run under the guise of pretending to run in the Democratic primary. Wisconsin judge orders 250,000 voters purged from the voter rolls in Wisconsin. And the Atlanta Journal-Council, or Courier? Atlanta's newspaper, top paper, study shows precinct closures dramatically harm turnout in Georgia. And try and guess in which particular cohort they hurt the most.
I thought it was police precincts for a second. I got excited.
Nope. Sorry. Voting precincts. And Pete Buttigieg helped with a plan to destroy the post office.
It's personal now.
Now you've done it, Pete.
Donald Trump looking to attack Social Security disability insurance. And Mexico box at the USMCA's labor standard protections. Lastly, reason number 15, although it could be really any number of reasons, why I may run against Chuck Schumer 2022. Why not? Precedent's been set. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This will be the final week of live broadcasts for this program in 2019.
There's this decade.
Holy cow. Yes, in this decade. I hadn't even contemplated that.
Really sneaks up on
you. Isn't there some type of like technicality that really the decade doesn't begin until the 2011.
Yeah, some people go by the first.
That's what Jay Gould did, and so that's the way I do it.
What was the Stephen
Jay Gould?
Stephen Jay Gould. 2009.
Then I like that.
Stephen Jay Gould was making an argument that we do not enter the 21st century until 2001.
Well, Stephen Jay Gould is good, and so I back that position.
I mean, math is not our strong
pure
suit, so
tribalism.
I guess I could defer to him.
Yeah, Gould is good, but I mean, the year zero would have felt like the new. Imagine if you were in the year zero, that would feel like a new decade.
Yeah, I know, but I think, you know, to a certain extent, they probably did that retroactively. I don't think people said, like, we've been in the negatives, and finally we
made it
we
caught up.
To year zero.
Finally we caught up. God. I do like Matt's sort of, like, there's a little bit of, there's some weed material there, Matt. It's like, year zero, man. Wouldn't it feel...
It's like, this is like a totally new beginning.
Like, we reset ourselves.
Totally
like,
nailed shape, it.
Like, cool is cool, but by December, I want a new start, man.
By December of the year of year zero, I would think the temptation to just say, like, dudes, we could just start this all over again. And you would never not have the year zero. You would just restart it again.
I mean, that's what we're trying to do, really.
We should do it again.
We should. Let's just turn the clock
reset.
All the way back. Nevertheless, it is the end of the decade, and I can't even remember what prompted that. This is our final, right? Our final live shows of the week. Now, what we will do is we are compiling the best ofs of everything, best of all of it, and we will have that for Christmas week. There's also a chance that I may hop on YouTube every now and then, do a little live stream. So you're forewarned. So you should go, if you're not subscribed for some reason to our YouTube page, I mean, I imagine that you are, know that that's an opportunity for you there. And we don't have in the app you can check the app. It will be, you know, even if you miss it live, you can check the app. There'll be updated videos, you know, on the app, as it were. And you can find that at majorityapp.com. We don't have a notification, text notification on our app anymore. We should probably institute something like that in the future for the five people who would want that. It's the Majority Report again. Great, on my phone. Ladies and gentlemen, before we get to our guest, as you know, one of the things that I've dedicated my life to after leaving show business for this profession was to attempt to rid the world, I guess, but really I was focusing on the United States, because you must deal, you know, clean up your own backyard first, is what I always said. And I have been fighting the good fight in the war on Christmas. For a while, it looked like I had won. There was a town in Wisconsin years ago that had sung Silent Night and did not include Jesus in it. And so I thought, I've won. There was a retail outlet that printed more Happy Holidays signs than they had the year before, though they had always said Happy Holidays, and I thought I had won. And then I came across this clip with Judge Jeanine talking to Eric Trump and his baby and his wife, whose names escape me, and everything was shattered.
Eric and I were talking about what's going on with impeachment and the FISA and all that. But will you guys be able to just forget about all of it and really enjoy the fact that you really are part of the first family? You are the first family. I mean, you've done wonderful things for this country. We now don't have the political correctness.
Pause it for 1 second. And I'm going to go back a little bit, but I just want to say, like, it is nice that Judge Jeanine feels that she needs to, you know, make these folks realize, like, to a certain extent, this is about you as well, right? Like, you are the first family, because this family, very well known for not really sort of taking in what their privilege is or what their status might be. They're so reticent to assume any status or privilege that it's nice to see that they're being encouraged to do so. But go ahead.
I mean, you've done wonderful things for this country. We now don't have the political correctness that we used to. I mean, people are actually saying Merry Christmas.
You can say Merry Christmas again.
Yes,
isn't that so nice, Jeanine?
I love it. I love Christmas trees. I love Santa over here. I mean, you know, how do you feel that your father has done all of that, Eric?
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. It is incredible. I mean, you no longer, I have to say, Allahu Akbar, and you can say Merry Christmas again. And you couldn't before, because, let's face it, there was a black guy and he was president and he would prevent us all from saying Merry Christmas.
Allahu Akbar, say it, devil.
He was a secret Muslim and made it impossible for us to do this. And yes, during that era, I had overjoy. I was joy was flowing. And then to hear that from Jeanine Pirro. However, within 24 hours, apparently, there had must have been some major turn. Because we are informed by Fox and Friends and Dennis Prager, Dean Dennis Prager, that the war on Christmas is back on. Here he is. Here is the scholar and dean, Dennis Prager.
27 minutes before the top of the hour, we've been telling you about this movie for quite a long time. Dennis Prager, radio talk show host and and founder of Prager U, joins us now to talk about not only the success of your movie, No Safe Spaces, but also talk about the need to say Merry Christmas. You're a religious scholar. Why should something like that matter?
Because this country, and I'm saying this as a religious Jew, I want to make that clear. This country is founded on Judeo-Christian principles. God is the source of our rights. That is in the Declaration of Independence. In God we trust is one of the mottos of this country. I know that secular intellectuals think that God is irrelevant to morality, God is irrelevant to meaning, God is irrelevant to human rights, God is irrelevant to freedom, but the founders and Americans until about the 1970s all thought that, nearly all, let's put it that way. I am deeply worried about the radical secularization of America, and the obvious arena, most obvious perhaps, is changing Christmas into holiday. Kids no longer have Christmas vacation, holiday vacation. Companies no longer have Christmas parties, holiday parties. And of course, it's happy holidays, not Merry Christmas. I would like to know why it's not inclusive. I'm a Jew. Christmas is not my religious holiday. It's my nation's holiday. It's a national holiday. Why am I excluded if you invite me to a Christmas party? What is not inclusive about that?
You're excluded from my Christmas party.
He agrees with you. Listen to this.
And by the way, under the Trump administration, you'll be saying Merry Christmas again. We are going to say Merry Christmas again.
Remember two things. Number one, I said we're going to be saying Christmas again.
They don't use the word Christmas because it's not politically correct. You go to department stores and they'll say Happy New Year and they'll say other things. Well, guess what? We're saying Merry Christmas again.
Okay. Now, clearly, there's a lot of disinformation in the war on Christmas. One hand, we Judge Jeanine says that we have lost, we've been vanquished. Then Prager says, no, the forces allied against Christmas have won. And then President Trump says, we're going to win. And if Prager's correct, then promise unkept by President Trump. But if President Trump is correct, then Prager's lying to us. And I would add, I don't think he is a religious scholar. My understanding is that he went to Brooklyn College with a major in history and Middle Eastern studies. Now, that's not the same as religion, but that's not important. But here's Dennis Prager going on and saying that
he listened to Ask Dr. Lorelei in the 90s.
Right, exactly.
That's his
we are
his
or not
training.
Saying Merry Christmas. And this is just absurd. I mean, aside from the fact that, the Declaration of Independence is not our Constitution. If something's not in our Constitution that was in the Declaration of Independence, guess what? That was probably one of the most conscious decisions that one could make in terms of how we wanted to launch this country, as it were. It is,
I don't know that Judeo-Christian values were a thing back then either.
Well, I mean, I think Judeo-Christian values existed. Of course they did.
Were people talking about it in that way?
Well, they were theists, some of them. And I don't know if they would say those words. But the point is that there was a myriad of different things. The Puritans outlawed celebration of Christmas. Now, that's the other thing. The idea that Christmas is in some way a substitute for saying, like, if you're anti-Christmas, you're anti-religion. Well, that's fundamentally untrue. The Christmas tree is a pagan symbol.
That's right.
It's not Judeo-Christian at all. In fact, you will find...
Did you learn that at Brooklyn College?
It's not hard to find big-time Christians who do not celebrate Christmas in this way. They find it grotesque. They find it just to be consumerist and whatnot. I mean, all of what I'm saying is, of course, probably exerting too much. I'm dedicating too much air
way
to
too much seriousness here.
But, yeah, but honestly,
what we have here is a syncretic religion of Christianity and capitalism. We all know that.
Yes, that's correct. And I would also add, it's so sad that they gotta keep going back to this. Like, I mean, on some level, it really is. It's indicative. And I haven't monitored this, but the more war against Christmas stuff you have, the more they're trying to avoid talking about stuff. And that may be an impeachment thing. And maybe over this week, you're going to hear just like a boatload of war on Christmas stuff. And so watch out, folks. If you're out there and you're singing Christmas songs, but you're changing the lyrics in some way to be inclusive, watch out, because you may end up becoming a national story. And enjoy.
Yeah, don't worry. We'll get the mistletoe ban passed soon, I believe.
I mean, personally, I have my own personal war on Christmas. I have my public one, and then I have my own personal one. So, but with that said, if you want to defeat me in the war on Christmas, I got a great idea for you. Because support for today's show comes from Mova Globes. Mova Globes, they turn all on their own. They got magnets and ambient lighting. Somehow makes them move. I don't understand how that works. But they have, you can have them on their own. You can have with or without a base. There's a couple of different types of bases they have. No batteries are needed, no wires, nothing. They have over 40 different designs. This one I'm holding here in my hand is the Earth that you would note it would look like from space, depending on the nature of the day. I mean, you'd have to be pretty far away. And of course, you wouldn't be able to see this much of the Earth as I'm seeing here now. See like a little portion of it from space. But they also have ones with antique maps. So they don't have all the countries that we are aware of today. You bringing in the second one for me? Oh, thank you. They have ones with fine art. They have an outer space collection with graphics from NASA and from the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. They have ones of Mars. You got to check it out. 40 different ones. It's a great gift for the person who has everything or for a kid who doesn't have much and is intrigued by maps and space and things that spin. They're very calming, too. Now, just in time for the holiday season, you can get 15% off your purchase when you visit movaglobes.com/majority and use the code majority. This is their biggest deal of the year, folks. It's only valid for a limited time. So head over MOVA, M-O-V-A, globes.com/majority. Use the coupon code majority for 15% off. That's movaglobes.com/majority. Now, the flip side of the holiday season is that, of course, a lot of people are shopping online. They're banking online. Hackers are using what is known as social engineering to try and obtain information about you through phishing scams, which they can then use to gain access to your bank account. If you watch Mr. Robot like I do, you know all about this stuff. It's partially a human and it's partially like jamming machines. So, for instance, you get a seemingly legitimate phone call from a bank. And it turns out to be a phone scam. And this one is actually true. It resulted in millions of dollars lost to hackers. They call up. They say, I'm from Chase Bank. No, they know maybe like 1 out of 10 people are at Chase Bank. But if they call up and say, oh, it's Mr. Johnson. I'm calling from Chase Bank. Having a little problem with your account. Could you just give us your Social Security number? And again, confirm for me your address. And then you confirm your address. And that's all they need. And they go in and they crack open whatever it is you're doing. Last year, almost 27,000 people reported being a victim of some sort of phishing scam. Every time you bank, shop, or browse online, you can be vulnerable to cyber criminals. A new Norton 360 with LifeLock membership provides you all-in-one protection with device security, identity theft protection, and a VPN for online privacy and more. Look, no one can prevent all cybercrime or identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But new Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally for your cyber safety during the holidays and beyond. Sign up today. Save up to 25% off your first year by going to Norton.com/majority. That's 25% off Norton 360 with LifeLock at Norton.com/majority. Terms, of course, apply. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to journalist Megan Winter about her book, All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program magazine writer, journalist, author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Megan Winter, welcome to the program. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Megan. Yes, thanks. Okay. Welcome to the
thanks
program. Let's just start. Over the course of a couple of years, actually, you were reporting in Missouri, Florida, and Colorado. Why those states?
Yeah. So I wanted to look at a number of states because I wanted to show that what's happening is not just in one place. And I wanted to be able to look at a number of different issues and show how they intersect and work together. And I wanted to look at places that aren't inevitably conservative or aren't inevitably progressive. So I chose those states because each of them kind of exemplified one of the different issues in politics, one being like the huge amount of money spent on the state level, another being the cultural issues and the culture war and race, guns, abortion, how they're used. And another, my editor told me I needed to define something hopeful or something where a place where things were working for progressives. And so I chose Colorado because they're doing a lot well there.
Was that the hardest part of it, finding the hopeful part? But maybe we shouldn't jump ahead to that. Well, because I like to save the hopeful part to the end.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's start though with this, which I really enjoyed and found, frankly, self-validating, was your look into liberal left. Big money donors, because you say that there's a qualitative difference, and this is something I've been arguing for years, a qualitative difference between the liberal left donors and the conservative right donors. Walk us through that, because that has implications in all three of these states.
Yeah, I think this is such an important point, and it's kind of the underlying issue, because unfortunately, as listeners know, so much of what happens in our politics has to do with money, unfortunately. So we often hear said, oh, the right has more money. And as we all know, there's a lot of emphasis put on like the Koch brothers, on the Heritage Foundation, and on all of these giant right-wing conservative libertarian groups that are pushing their agenda on the national and also local level across the country. But what I think is missing or much less discussed, although there's been more conversation about it in the past few years, is what are Democrats, what are left-leaning donors, what are centrist foundations not doing that those entities are doing? And a lot of it really comes down to not just the amounts of money, because actually centrist foundations have more money than these right-wing groups, but it's what are the incentives that are pushing them to fund or to not fund different kinds of work. So right-wing donors or conservative donors have a built-in incentive to give. It's a literal investment. So if I'm, you know, if I'm the Koch brothers, if I fund politicians that are then going to lower corporate taxes, of course, I make that money back plus much more by spending some money on those races. I spend $1 million, I might get $40 million back, right? So we all understand that. Whereas liberal or left-leaning donors, they tend to be more economically conservative and socially liberal than the American population in general. So they're much more willing to support abortion rights. They're against guns. They're for LGBTQ rights at higher rates than the American public. And they also are much, much more economically conservative, meaning they're not going to fund these sort of structural changes that are going to actually empower working people. They're actually going to empower poor people, even the middle class. Like those kinds of bigger structural changes are not things that they're going to fund. They're just not. So that's why we see a lot of these, and anyone who works for a nonprofit will recognize this problem, where liberal donors tend to give, you know, $10,000 at a time to some organization that they find interesting. You know, something, maybe it's, and I don't want to minimize the importance of these kinds of programs, but maybe it's something like helping, you know, arts with queer youth or something like that, that is important. Like I'm fully endorse those programs, but they're not the kind of programs that are actually going to bring about structural political change. Whereas donors on the right have built in incentive to create structural change that gives them more power over the long term. So liberal and centrist donors end up funding programs that maintain the status quo long term, rather than change the status quo in these pivotal ways that build recursive power. So even things like gerrymandering, Republicans have long invested in strategic programs or strategic elections that will change the system rather than do something that they think is interesting or, you know, that sparks their imagination. So it's like the moral whims of rich people is what guides the left, whereas their kind of strategic economic incentives guides the right, if I'm going to be reductive about it. So that's something I wrote about in the book. And I think it's really important for us to step back and realize what's happening there.
Right. And I would say this too, that, you know, I think it's also possible. I mean, I think it's actually true that, you know, on the right, they have deeply held political beliefs as well. So they don't even necessarily mm-hmm. have to get a net positive return on investment. They're going to get some like material return on investment, which the gulf, you know, can be filled with their ideological returns as well. Whereas that's not the same, as you say, on the left. And the other mm-hmm. way that I would describe it, and I've described it for years, is that I think there's also just a qualitative, almost personality aspect of people on the left. And mm-hmm. when they have money, they're wealthy people on the left. And by left, I mean, you know, basically running from the center to the left, mm-hmm. that they like to be thought of as creative, and that they like to exactly. fund. And you say at one point, like I can't quite make out what I wrote here, but unique special air to what they're providing, and mm-hmm. the idea of doing projects as opposed to operations, funding a unique project as opposed to like, here's your operations, guys. Keep running your organization for the next 2 years.
Exactly. Yes.
Also deeply problematic in terms of, because there's no opportunity to grind it out for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So something the right-wing donors are much more willing to fund the same nonprofit for 20 years. And that nonprofit doesn't have to sell itself as particularly new or glamorous, right? It just, and this is something really important for all of us to keep in mind. The things that are going to build, that are going to save our democracy from the brink, right, are not actually, they don't have to be these cutting edge, exciting, thrilling things. We need to just knock on doors, register people to vote. Like these basic primary building blocks, going to meetings, even if they're boring, and then discussing with your neighbors, like what you're going to do with the school board, those kinds of fundamental building blocks of democracy, the right has funded, and not only funded, but made, they've created a culture on the ground where those things are understood to be necessary and they're funded year in and year out. So if a nonprofit is, for example, organizing anti-abortion volunteers in church basements in the middle of the country, those efforts are funded and sustained and given prestige. Whereas on the left, exactly as you say, these, I heard time and again when interviewing political nonprofit directors and organizers on the ground, those kinds of day-to-day organizing efforts, which are so needed and are the only thing that has ever created social change in our country over years, those kinds of efforts are not funded and supported as much by donors on the left. And some of that has to do with, I mean, there's a long history about that, and I write about it in the book. There's some of it's a little bit too much of the weeds for our conversation now, but generally those kinds of things have not been as sustained on the left, and even frankly by like centrist people either. There's been a lack of organizing on the left over years, and that is a large reason that we find ourselves in the situation we are today. And that's the kind of work that you may not win your grant for, that because donors who are, and I don't want to fall into this sort of like elite thinking trap, but it's really true. A kind of elite person in San Francisco or New York may not, that might not strike their fancy as much as something that they perceive as exciting.
I do want to spend a little bit more on the mobilizing versus organizing. I'm not terribly mm-hmm. worried about getting too weedy here, but before we mm-hmm. get to those weeds, I just want to stay in these weeds for one more mm-hmm. moment. Like this, forgive me. I just did an interview the other day, and I can't remember exactly who it was with. I don't know if I dreamt it.
Understandable.
But about, these days. But we were talking about the cost of infrastructure, projects. And knowing that, and the biggest reason why infrastructure projects, I think it was particularly, we were talking about during the stimulus and the idea of non-shovel-ready mm-hmm. stuff is because you don't have consistent funding and you can't rely on funding. So the stopping and starting. And so mm-hmm. the value for an organization to know that they're funded for 5 years is exponential in terms of what it does for these organizations.
Oh, it's totally huge. I mean, I even relate to this as someone who's been a freelance writer, right? It's the kind of the feast famine mentality. I mean, just think about it. So I'm going to take a step back too. So something that I heard again and again, Ren, reporting this book, and I again was speaking to people in different states who are working on different issues, but the thing I heard the most was that Democrats and left-leaning interest groups, so those are groups like Planned Parenthood, Sierra Club, et cetera, those kinds of those institutions over time have not built up local organizations of volunteers and even paid staff on the ground the way that their counterparts on the right have. And again, these are just local organizations of people who are always there, not just before the election. So yes, the Democratic Party floods into swing states 6 months or 3 months or a week before an election, but that's not the same as having people on the ground who are paying attention to what's happening, who are changing the culture because they're always there and they're changing ideas about what's possible and what people want. And they're also connected to their communities in ways where they know what they know how to talk to people. They're of that neighborhood, right? And those kinds of groups are able to achieve a lot when they're well organized and when they're able to have a 5-year plan or a 2-year plan or whatever it is, because then they're able to say, okay, what we want is paid sick leave in our city. And how are we going to get it? It's going to take months or years to be able to achieve something like that. So they can hire organizers, they can have meetings, they can basically, they can have goals. I mean, as ridiculous as that sounds, whereas you can't have a goal if you only have funding for a very short amount of time and you don't know how much staff you're going to have. So on the right, we've seen time and again that they've been very proactive. They've laid out plans for decades at a time. That's what we're seeing happening with the federal courts, which are now increasingly held by conservative judges, especially now under Trump. And how did that happen? That didn't happen with 6 months of funding and 20 grand, right? That happened with decades of plotting, many institutions working together. And that kind of foresight and thinking and strategy is really only possible when you have institutions and you have organizations and you have people working, you know, at the top, but you also have people who are strategizing and laying plans. So, and getting their neighbors together in these ways that, again, they seem very mundane, but they're actually incredibly powerful when taken together. So that's the kind of thinking and strategizing that the left has not been as successful at, especially in, you know, the past few decades with unions decline, with the Democratic Party becoming more nationalized, et cetera. And a lot of that comes from the top in terms of how funders are deciding to spend their money. And at some point, we also have to realize that it comes from all of us. And are right. we actually going to our local meetings, too? So it's those things are starting to change potentially since 2016. It's just a matter of.
Will they be sustainable? You know,
this,
I mean,
and like, what would it take to make it sustainable? And like, these are all open questions. I don't have all the answers.
Oh, well, I was going to come around to you giving us the answers in a bit. So you'll have another couple of minutes before we get there.
Okay.
But what you've just described is what you outline in the book is the failure of the center and left, broadly speaking, in terms of like historically focusing on mobilization versus organization. In other words, you've just outlined that. Come in, motivate people for 6 months, wrap up the, you know, and move on to the next town, essentially, as opposed to leaving institutions there that will create, that will be ongoing in organizing. And yes, I think we're definitely seeing at least more organizing happening, but we will get to that in a bit because I want to go to also another problem that your book is that we've identified sort of like the not the funding disparity, but the disparity in the efficiency of the funding. When we talk about all politics being local and we look at the devastation that Democrats specifically, but the left more broadly suffered, you know, over certainly over the Obama years, but, you know, has been growing. Why have regional politics up until, I think, really 2016? I mean, I think we've seen an explosion of it. But why was that ignored prior to then?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think part of the reason is, and this is going back quite a ways, of course, but part of it is on the Democratic side, just their ideology, like, right. A lot of this is coming out of the civil rights movement. And for very good reason, the people who came up through the civil rights movement or were just alive at that time, it doesn't make sense to push a civil rights reform through a state house in the South, right? Like that's not the way it's going to work. And if you believe, as most Democrats believe that the federal government, you know, should have power and these it's good to nationalize various programs. It makes sense to want to win control in Congress and in the presidency. And I'm not going to argue against that. It makes sense to me too, to a certain extent. But then what ultimately happened is for, you know, a number of reasons, Democrats neglected, not only did they go after Congress and the presidency, but they also neglected state and local elections. For a number of reasons, some of to do with campaign finance and some of it going back to what we were talking about before in terms of just the Democrats the people who came to have power in the Democratic Party, their vision of success or prestige tended to be much more on the federal level. And it became harder to raise money for state-based work. Again, going back to the fact that the donors that they were asking money from did not see the importance of investing in long-term state-based work. So that, you know, the funding was a major issue.
So in other words, if I was a billionaire Democrat, right? And just let's say my name was like Tom or something.
Right.
And it would make more sense to me to spend $60 or $70 million on trying to say five words at a debate, let's say, for a federal office, than essentially winning three states over to all Democratic control.
Right. Well, no, Tom Steyer is a perfect example. Yes. He's sort of like the caricature of what has been the reigning view for years. So he is like Tom Steyer, obviously running for president. All your listeners will be well aware. He is actually he came up in a number of my interviews even before he was running for president, because he's been a longtime donor to progressive causes. And in particular, you know, he emphasizes the environmental movement. However, for example, and I write about the climate, I write about Florida and how energy companies have taken hold of the state house there and are preventing efforts to address climate change, which is happening across the country. But I use Florida as an example. And Steyer has done exactly what Democrats have done across the country for years, which is he funds these short-term blitzes of registering voters. But the moment an election is over, for example, the 2018 election there, which got a lot of coverage, the moment that's over, his organization is disposable. It collapses and it goes somewhere else. Whereas if there are organizations on the ground like Organize Florida or the New Florida Majority Project, these organizations that are still there, right? And they're still trying to do the work, and they're a better model of kind of continuous work. So that's kind of an aside, but I think that actually example really illustrates the two different ways that you can operate. So for years, basically, state races didn't have a lot of prestige. There were a number of progressive organizers who are like very smart, even well-connected people who tried to create, you know, Alex of the left, and they
Alex could not being the American Legislative Exchange Council,
yes,
which
I'm sorry, yes, they were
model,
trying to create right. these Yeah, they were trying to create model legislation to train lawmakers, but state houses just don't have a lot of prestige. And a lot of this is sort of the boiling frog metaphor, whatever that is. Like, you can't tell the frog is boiled until it is. So that, I think, is also what happened. And again, also the national press. The press has become increasingly nationalized. There are fewer and fewer state house reporters. And even where there are state house reporters, they're extremely overworked, and they don't have the bandwidth to pull back and show, you know, yes, there's an anti-union bill moving through the state house in Missouri, but that anti-union bill is also in 12 other states, and it's being funded by this person, and it has to do, you know, that kind of national scope, bird's eye view. There are very few platforms, if any, that are able to show what's actually happening, because the state house reporters are focused on their local gaze, and the national press, frankly, is not very interested, and or they only cover these things after they've happened. So I'm not sure that people, donors, volunteers, all of us, I'm not sure we were actually educated enough about what was happening to even put up a defense until it was almost too late, if not too late, which is why I was motivated to write the book. So I think, I mean, there's many reasons, but those are the ones that kind of rise to the surface for me.
Yeah, I was going to I want to spend just a little bit more time on the implications of the sort of the local press, not only there being a disconnect between the local press, but now I think it's sort of just sort of the absence of a local press that can't get these stories into the bloodstream. But before we get there, let's just stay a little bit closer to the parties for one more moment. And then I promise folks we'll get to the hopeful part, or the moderately hopeful part.
I'm a pessimist, so we don't even have to go there.
Well, I just want to make sure that people keep tuning in to the show. So
right,
we need to have some hope. The relationship of the Democrats to the consultant class, and particularly as it deals with like field work, because This mm-hmm. is something that, you know, we've had callers, frankly, who work in electoral politics, who said that field work was a big problem in 2016, at the very least. I think maybe things have improved in 2018, but there is a structural disincentive for mm-hmm. field work on the left that is, I guess, presumably would have been done at one point by unions in the past on the left and is done currently by religious entities on the right to some extent. Just walk us through that.
Yeah, this is so important. And again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but this does go back to the lack of organizations on the ground that are long-term, volunteer-run or driven, and are people who are actually invested in their own hometowns or their own counties and states. So because there's this huge lack of those kinds of organizations, and to a certain extent in some places like Indivisible and other groups have begun to fill in that gap, which is great. But, historically in recent years, there's been this huge gap on the left. And so when there is a campaign and suddenly someone like Tom Steyer does throw $10 million at a race or whatever it is, then what happens is paid canvassers are hired to go door to door. And that and or the consultants who are working on the race, many of whom have their resume is just full of other failed races that they've worked on because they're in these states where Democrats have trouble winning. And yet who else are campaigns going to hire? So they rehire these people who've only, helped give advice before. Anyway, so those people will often take out TV ads or they'll take out radio ads. And the consultants have an incentive to focus more on the TV ads and also just hiring canvassers, because then they're a part of this, whole political industry. And I've heard also that they get kickbacks for signing up the TV ads, et cetera.
They get, I think it's out, like 10 or 15% markup essentially is what it is when they place these ads.
Yeah. So they have an incentive to be in this world. Listeners will know this and you know this, there's also just sort of a stylistic and ideological difference between the consultants who are more ingrained in the TV and increasingly online ads versus people who come up through a community organizing mentality and who are more. There's been a fair amount of political science research, and I've heard from a number of people on the ground just anecdotally that what really works and seems to persuade people is actually when someone from their own zip code knocks on their door and engages them in a real conversation.
Right.
That has been shown to actually encourage someone to go out and vote. But again, those kinds of programs where you have volunteers who are from that zip code, who are motivated to actually go talk about why they want to improve their school or why whatever their issue is their issue. To get those volunteers, you have to do a lot of legwork. It's laborious. It's hard. And those are the kinds of programs that, for example, Obama built up a lot of those kinds of organizing programs, although as soon as he was elected, again, they collapsed and were disposable. Whereas these organizations
that Obama specifically wanted to end those outside organizations.
Exactly. So if we had had a different. If there had been a different mentality, if everything had been different and there had been a way for the Organizing for America out of the Obama campaign to actually continue to be successful for other initiatives or for other, who knows what.
If they were allowed to maintain their independent power, which I think the Obama administration perceived as a threat, it would be a very different, I think, 10 years. And I would also
right.
add,
Who knows? Yeah.
Acorn. People forget
exactly.
That because of O'Keefe and Project Veritas, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what they called it at the time, had these sort of nefarious videos, and there was no stomach for the Democratic Party to protect. This was an organization that with, maybe a $25 million budget did a massive amount of organizing on the ground. For people of color and people and people basically living in poverty or
exactly.
close to it. And that just
exactly.
got rolled
no.
up in the course of a month. It was gone.
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up. I write about that in the book. And in Florida, Acorn was a major presence and they were shut down. And what I thought was really interesting about that was everyone I spoke to in Florida brought up Acorn and how it was shuttered. And they saw that as an example of what could have been and how difficult it is to maintain that kind of organization. And what I thought was really interesting in Florida, too, was it wasn't just the, you know, people who identify as progressives who continually brought up Acorn, but it was also, you know, Alex Sink, who ran for governor in Florida in 2010 as, you know, very intentionally running as a moderate who got a lot of criticism for her work in the banks, et cetera. And she repeatedly brought up Acorn and how important that organization was. And so those, I think Democrats in general working on the ground in these places or trying to win local elections keenly understand the need for those kinds of organizations and how they're lacking. And, you know, hopefully this is something that will change going forward. But there is, as you said, there's this built-in, no one gets money, no one gets rich trying to run a large-scale field operation. Whoever was working for Acorn, those people were making, I can only guess, personal sacrifices, right, for working at those kinds of organizations for low pay and it's difficult work. These campaigns, especially, you know, the people operating those campaigns have much more incentive to focus on TV, to focus on social media. And those things in some cases may work in the short term, but they do not work in the long term in terms of building these long-term structures that if they don't win an election in the short term, they may win. You know, they may change the culture war conversation. Right. They may bring paid family leave or the minimum wage or climate change to the fore in a way that, you know, changes the long-term political understanding of what's possible in a community. So and just connecting this to the media conversation, it is like infuriating to me personally how much coverage, especially this 2020 race, is about the presidential horse race. But if we look at it, there's a lot of money to be made in the horse race, right? Like there's money for advertising, there's money for, it's cheaper for CNN or whoever to put on a pundit rather than a reporter who's been out there covering the EPA or housing crisis, or closing hospitals, like whatever would take investigative reporting. So it's cheap for, not cheap, but it's less expensive for media outlets to do that kind of horse race. But the horse race stuff, in its way, lends credence to the consultant class, because when you right. think that all that matters is, you know, the way that someone speaks or whether they have a gaffe or, you know, whether they're charming to a certain part of the electorate.
Who's won the media narrative of the day?
That misses the point. It's right. not. Yes. Part of it is whether people are charismatic and whether their policies are generally appealing to, you know, people. But it also has to do with whether people turn out to vote. But there's not a lot of money to be made in making sure people turn out to vote, whereas there's a huge amount of money to be made in running ads about whether someone's charming. But that is, it's such a failure on so many, on multiple levels of our politics that's what it's come down to.
All right.
And it's scary. I mean, it's scary looking at the coverage of 2020 is really scary. And there's just no money to be made in talking about turning out the vote, in talking about grassroots organizing, and there's no money to be made in actually doing it. So, I mean, all of this circles back to the need for the American public to, you know, if you have free time, volunteer, because it's the only real solution, even though that sounds like such a boring solution. I don't know. I just find it very disheartening the kind of circle between the media consultants kind of punditry. That whole circle it's not the way that Democrats are going to win long term.
All right. Well, let's look at one thing. Let's leave on a hopeful note, and maybe we can talk about with the Colorado Gang of Four, as you call it, or mm-hmm. Just a story that will and. I think we've also seen, at the very least, you know, in the wake of 2016, there are more organizations that are out there. You said Indivisible, and and also I think the DSA in many respects is filling that, and
definitely
even ad hoc groups that have grown up where, you know, donors at the very least, you know, are. Small donors are aggregating their funds and adopting a couple of races in Colorado.
Definitely. And there's, like Sister District, and there's, the DSAs, and there's even the Democratic parties on the ground have been reinvigorated in certain places. And there's a lot of interesting conversations happening there too. I mean, yes, definitely.
Well, give us an example from Colorado just so that we can leave
note. I mean, sort of joking, but sort of not. I did look at Colorado because I needed to find somewhere where something was working. So Colorado is an interesting example for a couple of reasons, but just briefly, during the George W. Bush administration, a number of donors there decided that they wanted to get involved, and they explicitly decided that they wanted to work on the state level, which is not something that left-leaning or Democratic donors, again, typically decide that they're going to make that their priority. But this group of donors did. And also what's amazing about what they did is after they won a few elections on the state level, they didn't just walk away. They decided that they were going to help build these organizations that were doing exactly what we were just talking about, where they were not going to leave after the election. They were actually going to work on policy. They were going to cultivate talent. They were going to create a sense of community, all of these different things. So they basically created almost a replacement for the Democratic Party, which for a number of campaign finance reasons, the parties are just not capable of doing what they once did. So this group came together. They funded a number of organizations, and I looked in particular. I wanted to tell this story through people. So I found these incredible people who just their presence actually made me hopeful. This group of friends from they'd been in student government in University of Colorado, and then they came up through this system where they started because of the, you know, generosity and investment from this group of donors, they were able, and because of their own, like, truly incredible people, like, just so committed and hardworking. And they're just, you know, when you watch people and you're like, okay, you're talented, these people have that. And they created this youth voting organization that registers young people, but it also, it pulls young people into the political process, because it's run by young people. So it really is, it's called New Era Colorado. It's a pretty incredible organization. It's part of a kind of a consortium now of other youth organizations. But I found them impressive because they're just able to get things done. And they've pushed legislation on things like student loans, and they've lobbied on a number of issues. They've grown talent. Like, they're a congressman from Colorado, Congressman Jonah Goose. He was one of the founding members. The state's Senate majority leader now, Steve Fenberg, was the main founder. Representative Leslie Herod, who's in the Colorado Assembly, and she's sponsored bills on like ending cash bail. She's done a lot with people in addiction and helping them get recovery. Just people who've gotten a lot done and have climbed up relatively early in their careers. Founded this organization. And I think it's just important to see that people can get things done and they can work together. And I was just, I just like the idea that this is this group of friends who in a field that's very competitive, were supporting each other and, you know, enabled each other's success really.
Well, it's a really important dynamic and book, and I don't know what the solution is in terms of that donor side, but more and more, I think, particularly you look at a campaign like the Sanders campaign that is funded with a total absence of big donors at every facet. There may be if we find sort of like that group of middle managers, I guess, who are willing to dedicate resources to building these long-term institutions. There's the hope, folks. The book is All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Megan Winter, thank you so much for joining us. We'll put a link to your book at majority.fm and in our podcast and YouTube description. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half in a moment. We have clips about the smearing of Cenk Uygur by the New York Times. We have clips of Lindsey Graham, who, you know, I think even...
What happened to Lindsey Graham?
We're going to investigate that question. Also,
bless you.
Bless you.
That would be an awesome character arc if Matt was like sincerely a fan of Lindsey Graham and genuinely perplexed.
I honestly had this conversation with my dad. You know, my dad is a left liberal. Liberal center. I mean, he would never vote for, I don't think he would vote for a Republican per se. Although, you know, it's not inconceivable to me that there's been a Republican governor he's voted for. I could see him voting for Weld at one point. I don't think he did, but it's not seemed too far afield. But he was saying to me, he's like, what happened to Lindsey Graham? What a piece of garbage. And I'm like, Dad, he's always been a piece of garbage. Well, he used to seem more reasonable. And I'm like, that's just because that's just where he was feeding from. That's all. I mean, that's just, it just so happens to have been like his trough.
You don't understand me, old man. Where I was feeding from.
Exactly. I mean, it's just.
That'd be cool if Lindsey Graham could actually, like the McLuhan scene, he just keeps explaining himself.
Sam's right. I've always been a piece of garbage.
You don't understand.
It's just that the sun was in a different space in the sky. And
garbage.
You see the garbage side of me. That's all.
When I wanted to do something fake about global warming, it was the garbage move. Wait. When I want to say global warming doesn't exist, it was the garbage move.
Exactly.
Always garbage.
If John McCain, you know, it's all just like I was drafting off of John McCain. And when that went, I just ended up drafting off of Donald Trump. That's all. I'm a drafter.
John McCain, Donald Trump, there's no loyalty in this game.
He starts doing the
cheese
monologue.
Don't hate the player. Don't hate the player. I hope that guy loses his seat. I hope he's this. It could be
I hope
better.
Things that
see
I cannot
someone
who's say
like,
on
just
air.
Sort of like sells his soul so publicly.
And sells it for the public for the pleasure of it, though. Like there is clearly no discomfort.
Do people remember when Donald Trump like handed out his phone number?
He literally. I walked into the office, and you guys said Donald Trump just doxed Lindsey Graham, and I was like, yeah, okay. And then you're like, no, seriously, watch this.
That was when Donald Trump seemed like only a threat to the GOP.
That was when Donald Trump was awesome.
He went full MIA on his ass.
That was so amazing. He's like, this guy called me, begs me to get on Fox and Friends, even though he's terrible at television. Maybe you should give him a call.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, reminder, this program relies on your support to continue. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get this, the free show, free of commercials, and you get extra content every single day. Jointhemajorityreport.com for just pennies a day. And of course, if you are someone who does not have the financial means to join the show and support it, but you, whatever your situation is, the extra content would in any way help your situation or make you feel better or whatever. We will never allow finances to be a bar to the extra content of this show. You can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have a little patience because it takes a while for us to get around to emails, but we will hook you up. That's jointhemajorityreport.com. Or send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. We're going to be doing the AM Quickie through for most of vacation, I think. Pretty sure. So check it out. And you get, you know, at the very least, a couple updates. Any news that's going on, any stories that you should know about, amquickie.com. Or you can listen to both shows on the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And remember, every time you bank, shop, or browse online, you can be vulnerable to cyber criminals. A new Norton 360 with LifeLock membership provides you an all-in-one protection with device security, identity theft protection, and a VPN for online privacy, and more. Well, look, no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But new Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally for your cyber safety during the holidays and beyond. Sign up today. Save up to 25% off your first year by going to norton.com/majority. That's 25% off Norton 360 with LifeLock at norton.com/majority. Terms apply.
Always,
Michael.
Always with the terms.
Today is Monday.
Indeed.
Tomorrow will be Tuesday.
Indeed.
And
Joshua Kahn Russell is joining us to talk about activism and resiliency. How you actually.
Oh, that dude. I like that dude.
Really good dude. Really excited to have him on. Usually he's in studio, but tomorrow we're going to be doing it over the phone. Then Ilona Minkowski comes in studio. We're going to be talking about the just travesty of this new Pentagon budget. Donald Trump. Everybody can agree is a dangerous sociopath, but the gravy keeps going, and he gets his Space Force. We're going to be digging into that, as well as Yemen and a whole bunch more. That's Michael Brooks' show, streaming live tomorrow at 7 o'clock on the Michael Brooks YouTube channel. Patreon.com/TMBS to get the whole thing. And grab your tickets. We sold out Philly weeks in advance. There's a link to the Bell House for our February 7th live show at Matt Binder, Pretty Bad Lefty, Ilona Minkowski, Harvey Kay, and Ben Burgess. Tonight or tomorrow morning, our website's launching, and you can buy merch.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we speak with Alex Vitale. He's a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the author of The End of Policing, about the history of the modern police state, why liberal reforms have failed through the years or even proven counterproductive, and what would need to happen to actually fix some of these problems, which are, spoiler alert, driven by inequality and austerity. We also talk about the ongoing FTP protests in New York City and connect them up to protests around the world. Really inspiring stuff. Also, today we've released a bonus for our patrons, which is Andy's new series, Talkin' Tina, where he talks about political issues in Latin America. And in this episode, he had on Camilo Gomez, a Peruvian journalist. They talk about a lot of really interesting and weird stuff, including, various Posadist sects that still endure. They talk about market socialism in the Peruvian context and whether that's even worth saving. Just check it out. It's always interesting when Andy does Latin American stuff. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Literary Hangover. We just did The Crucible by Arthur Miller. Coming up next is The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, the second most published book of all time in the English language. And it makes sense, or it's kind of good that we're having Joshua Kahn on, because he kind of reminds me of a Pilgrim's Progress character, because Christian, at the beginning of Pilgrim's Progress, is sitting in his field reading his Bible, and he's like, what do I need to do? I know where I need to go, but what do I need to do? And Evangelical yes. comes around and says, just go down that way. That's what Joshua Kahn does
That's
to
what
a socialist.
Kahn does for a socialist. That's right.
When socialists are like, well, how do I do anything about this? Joshua Kahn's like, well, it's very simple.
Here's actually a lesson from what I did to Arpaio in 2010.
Yeah, stop.
With the Simpsons analogy.
Relax with the anxiety and go, do something.
Indeed.
Look out for that. That's going to come out next Saturday.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 and the alpha males. males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back,
back. I'm the T-Rex.
Back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank.
They're Christian.
Hell out of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! Black, come on! Black, come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.